Hello and welcome to the next edition of Buffalo Who Knew podcast series, which highlights the often underappreciated, sometimes unearthed assets of Buffalo, particularly as it relates to the art and culture and built environment of Buffalo. And I'm thrilled today to have as our guest, Clint Brown, who is a venerable and widely respected architect and preservationist in Western New York. Clint, welcome. And Newell Nussbaumer, of course, my partner in crime here on this podcast series. And we're here today to talk about a really fascinating book that Clint has written about one of the great sections, not only of Buffalo, but also widely recognized as one of the great neighborhoods in the United States. So welcome, Clint. Let's get into it. So talk to us about your book, Olmsted's Elmwood, and the Elmwood Village for those who are not in Buffalo.
Well, thank you, Fritz. And thank you, Newell. I think the title of the book could have been Buffalo, Who Knew? I have been here all my life, having been brought from my native Niagara Falls to an apartment my parents were living in at summer in Norwood on my first day out of the hospital. And I've been stuck in the same postal code ever since, and suddenly it became okay. And in fact, it became okay. It sort of changed the dynamic of the community I grew up in, not necessarily positively, in terms of attracting new investment, which is necessary, but attracting new buildings that didn't fit into Elmwood's historic character. And my natural inclination would be to be angry and be an activist about that. And I realized people don't know, and in fact, I don't know anything about the neighborhood I grew up in. So I had
Nor
to figure
I,
out.
Nor did I, having grown up here as well. I didn't realize that what an important and beautiful and wonderful area it is. So I'm thrilled to dig down deeper into your findings on that.
And who knew that one of your ancestors was a client of Buffalo's greatest architect, Louise Bethune? So it was those hidden gems. I want to acknowledge that we're on the traditional territory of the Haudenosaunee, particularly the Seneca Nation, the keepers of the Western Door. And that's very important for a couple of reasons. One is, one of the things Elmwood and Buffalo needs is reconciliation. And we need to learn more about each other and how to work better together to make this a more desirable place for everyone. Another reason is that they invented a very specific way of living here that no other native tribe on the continent did, the longhouse. And we're sort of in a longhouse of sorts now, which is a big house for a lot of people and activities. But for an architectural historian, there are no longhouses left, except the reconstructed one at Ganongadon State Park. However, the Senecas are still here, of course, as people, their descendants, but they're also here in the street pattern that Joseph Ellicott used in laying out Buffalo in 1804. In fact, he named those streets after American Indian tribes. And my theory is that Olmsted's Chapin Parkway, from Gates Circle to Soldier's Circle, is the same route of a native trail from Maine and West Ferry and East Ferry, where there was a spring, hence the shortest route along Ferry to the crossing of the Niagara. But this one was heading northwest to a Seneca village on the banks of the Skajakwata, and on the other side of Skajakwata, a Tonawanda village. I think he took that route in making his park and parkway armature around which Elmwood grew.
Got it. So let's do this for those who are less familiar with Buffalo, who might not have been to Buffalo to see our park system. Let's do a little chronology of starting with, you know, we had Buffalo very prosperous with the Erie Canal, acting as the terminus of the Erie Canal. And then growth patterns started to migrate northwards. So we started to see post-Civil War formation of this village, what became the Elmwood Village, right?
Yes. The first settlers here of European descent sort of lived randomly. A family named Middaugh built a cabin on where Canal Side is now, just because that was a great place to be on a creek. Samuel Wilkerson and others made the creek a river, navigable, that attracted the terminus of the Erie Canal, and it filled the 1804 plan of Joseph Ellicott that really went to the current Chippewa Street, because it's about a 15-minute walk from the waterfront to Chippewa Street, and most of us live in 15-minute cities, depending on the technology. Now it's a further 15 minutes is a further geography. So the Erie Canal boom burst the original Ellicott plan. This was forest. This was dense primeval forest. There was only West Ferry Street now.
The Elmwood Village was forest.
We're sitting in the Elmwood Village right now. And Forest Avenue, because that skirted Skajakwita Creek. Otherwise, it was almost impenetrable. And a road from the foot of Buffalo to Batavia, called the Batavia Road, which was Main Street. So that's an Aboriginal trail that was reused in Ellicott's plan. Olmsted comes fast forward to 1868. Buffalo is a boom town after the Civil War. The Buffalo billionaires get together and say, we have to be competitive. New York City has a Central Park. We need to attract labor and capital, which was the issue for the builders of Buffalo regarding the Erie Canal era. But now we're a generation later. And they say, we got to bring in our friend Fred. Many of us have worked with him on the Sanitary Commission during the Civil War in Washington. And if we could just get him here, so this is 1868, he finally, after a year of importuning, arrives in August and on his way to and from Chicago. And they pick him up at the station. They take him around in a carriage ride to look for their Central Park, Buffalo's great park. And they show him what's now Front Park, what's now the parade, or Martin Luther King Jr. Park, and what was a swamp, which is now Delaware Park. And he went to Chicago, came back, and they met him at the station and said, well, Fred, we got about 70 of our fellow business leaders coming to meet at Sherman Jewett's house on Thursday evening. Can you come give us a little talk? He had a day and a half to put together with one of his assistants what he described that night as a vision of parks and parkways. Gentlemen, you're not looking for one central park. You have the opportunity to link all the potential parks and create a network of parks. That was a huge breakthrough. That was the invention of the parkway. And what's fascinating about the parkway is it's both path and place. Mm-hmm. It's not a median between two directions of a street. It's a place that you can occupy. You can plant double and triple rows of trees.
So, or go cross-country skiing on it, which I did today. Which is absolutely
exactly
brilliant.
Exactly. Yeah. And when I was a kid, there were still people riding horses on Chapin. Mm-hmm. So what was important is that this was an act of healing after the trauma of the Civil War. It was deliberate on everybody's part that we were going to bring nature into the city, and we're going to use these parkways as places to cause development. So this was not just the business leaders looking out for their workers and trying to attract more workers, because in those days you located your business where the workers were, similar to today. It was a business deal. It was tax increment financing. So they got together with Mayor Rogers. He was one of these businessmen at that meeting, formed a committee that lasted a generation in building out this vision laid out that night in August 1868. And financed it by a state-backed bond, half of which was paid by assessments of properties that fronted the parks and parkways, and the other half was paid by city revenues. So it was an economic deal, the likes of which we haven't seen before, except maybe, no, I don't think we've seen anything like it before or since, transformed and created Buffalo's nature. I think E.B. Green gave Buffalo's its face with his building. But in terms of its nature, excuse the pun, this park and parkway system is Buffalo's most distinguishing feature, I think, other than the waterfront, or along with the waterfront.
So here's the framework that's being created, this incredible park system, these innovative parkways that are connecting the parks. How is it that Elmwood started to be developed, and what was the temperature there? Was the inner city of Buffalo becoming so crowded and polluted that, you know, it dispersed people? People sought further to go farther afield to get away from all of that?
Yes, this was a place where the Chamber of Commerce sold evening views of factories belching fire and smoke 24/7. But the business leaders at the time who owned those factories said, we need a place of refreshment for our workers on their days off. And in the second report, the Buffalo Park Commissioners, the private group who worked with the city to put this together, but it was privately built, they said, this is not, what we're doing is not for us. Any rich man can afford his own estate and park. We're doing this for the people who are in the drudgery of the office, the shop, the factory floor. And we know that they are appreciative because they come in the wagons and carts of their trade on their day off. Prior to that, there were only groves that you had to pay to enjoy, usually with your ethnic group, and Forest Lawn Cemetery, which moved in 1848-49 to its current location here in Elmwood Village. It was the first park, rural cemetery park, but it was quickly overrun by the dramatic doubling of the population related to the opening of the Erie Canal and the jobs after the Civil War. So at that time, even as late as the 1870s and 80s, these were farms. And one of the Buffalo Who Knew was that so much of this area was developed by women developers. There was one in particular, Elizabeth Miller, who would buy up block-like tracts of land and subdivide them and sell them. So she owned all of West Ferry north to Lafayette and Richmond to Delaware at one point. That there was a huge role in women developers and women who designed houses like Louise Bethune, women who built houses.
Who, for you know, those listening, was the first certified woman architect in the country, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And operated in Buffalo, operated her practice with her husband in Buffalo. And what was it about Buffalo that had this you know, breed of women developers? What do you think drove that?
I think that two private high schools had a lot to do with it. Buffalo business leaders formed Buffalo Seminary so that their daughters had an equal education to that of their sons. Mm-hmm. And Buffalo Seminary moves here in Elmwood, just as the streetcars do, to a building that's designed in a collegiate style but has nothing feminine about it. So they were treated as equal partners. And Bishop Tyman, who turns out, I learned from Bill Collins and Tim Bowen, was a great feminist. He brought over women to be nuns to start schools and hospitals. So they start Miss Narden's Academy. If you grew up here, you called it Narden's because it goes back to Miss Narden's. Now it's called Narden Academy, which was educating Catholic women, giving them an independent education. So this was a place that was safe for women at a time after the Civil War when women had a lot of power, not just at that level, but the houses were deliberately and the lots were deliberately marketed to women. You buy or build a double, you live in one level, rent out the other level, and you live rent-free.
You've got some income. Yeah.
And that was deliberately marketed. And they had all the conveniences, indoor plumbing, screens on the windows, awnings, soundproof walls, because their parents had grown up in tenements downtown in the walkable city where the value was how close everything was. So you lived vertically. Here you lived horizontally. And the first streetcar was horse-driven, starts coming here, and then it gets electrified after the power plants at Niagara Falls open. So that 15-minute geography suddenly goes from downtown Buffalo to Forest Avenue, when previously the city's limit was limited to what you could walk in about 15 minutes.
So the predominantly, we're talking about the 1880s, 1890s, where these neighborhoods start to get developed and infill starts to happen, and gracious Victorian homes. And this is, so this is not according to Joseph Ellicott's plan still this far north, correct?
That's correct. But however, the tentacles of that plan, Olmsted drew on. So at that point, when Olmsted arrives, there is a undefined Rogers Avenue, roughly from what's now Symphony Circle to Colonial Circle, that is the backyard of lots fronting Niagara River from the Niagara Reservation, which the state platted in 1804. And the front lots here started at Main Street and went back to that lot. That's so if you owned, there were 12 people who owned everything that's now Elmwood. 10 in the 1820s. But of course, now it's about 6,000 people. But the front lots were Main Street and then cut back to Delaware. When Delaware became prominent, it was the place of all the millionaires. If you did well, you moved to Delaware. But they still owned all the way back to Richmond. So Olmsted knits together those two competing grids, Black Rock and Ellicott, because he extends the Ellicott orthogonal grid north. Meanwhile, the Black Rock pattern is perpendicular to the line of the river 1 mile in. So what is now called Richmond Avenue, Olmsted called the Avenue. It was one of the unmedianed parkways that connected from Colonial Circle to collect the west side to go to Delaware Park. The Crescendo Park. So that's why you knew growing up here, why did Richmond taper to a smaller width north of Colonial Circles? Because who would go north of Colonial Circle when you'd come up Richmond and turn right, if you're going north, to head to Soldiers and then go to the park that you really wanted to go to, Delaware Park. And the last farm was the Bidwell Farm, which was in the northwest corner of Colonial Circles, Lafayette and Richmond, that's now Manchester and those other spaces. So this is part of the culture, and it's no surprise that in the after this declines with the Depression, with the rise of the automobile, with which is the widening of the street, which the Elmwood Village Association diswidened, narrowed to everybody's benefit. The flight is...
When was that?
At the Depression, the 20s and the 30s.
Okay.
So the Albright House gets demolished. The Larkin House gets demolished. The streets...
People can't afford the upkeep anymore. And the taxes.
And that's right. And so the sons and daughters of the who grew up on Delaware Avenue go into the Park Lane and to 800 West Ferry, Campanile, that were deliberately designed for the next generation that didn't have the wealth of the previous generation that were the ones who built so much of the Buffalo we love today. So what happens for 70 years? There's nothing that happens here. That's why Elmwood is so intact. It looks so much
like... Well, that's what I want to talk about, which is so fascinating, because if you go to peer cities of Cleveland and Detroit, they don't have an Elmwood Village in the middle of their city. I mean, it's as though, I can't remember the preservation term. Is it preservation by stasis? Or there's some term that acknowledges the fact that decline can keep things intact.
Intact.
Mostly intact.
Yes, of course.
I mean, we've lost a lot of great buildings.
But not in Elmwood. Not in Elmwood.
Well,
95% of the buildings here were here when they were created and looked much the same. Our congruence of...
I'm talking about like M&T Bank. I'm talking about Rite Aid.
We'll come forward.
So we have for two generations, there's virtually nothing going on here because the growth has tapered off, and the growth there is has gone to the Parksides and the Amhersts, the West Senecas. You know, however the radial took your ethnic group out of the city to claim their enclave, and the core got hollowed out. Meanwhile, we're not redlined, Elmwood is not redlined, but so much of the city is, and you couldn't get out of where you were if you were a person who was in a redlined neighborhood, mm-hmm. because frankly, we were Europeans of English descent, and we didn't like Catholics. I mean, the Catholics didn't arrive here in Elmwood until the 1940s with the Newman Center at Buffalo State College. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Even though the cathedral was at Delaware, that was sort of a separate section there than the one we're in now. So we were not friendly even to Catholics here, those of us who lived here at the time. Mm-hmm. So we sort of stagnated. And then we got...
But on that point, again, I've never really heard a great explanation of this. Why do you think people stayed intact in this neighborhood, people being, you know, obviously Caucasian Protestant? Why did they stay in this neighborhood versus fleeing to the suburbs as a lot of other people did?
I think it's because of the institutions, Fritz, that they inherited. The churches that were still here, the schools that were still here. These were the finest public schools. I went to Buffalo Public School 30, which is now the M&T Bank site. Wendy Pierce was the first preservationist. She was the one who tried to prevent the demolition of our beloved grade school. There was the history of families who grew up here, but the next generation ended up on Highland or Ashland, Norwood, when a previous generation may have been closer to Delaware. So, for instance, the Goodyears, there are still some Goodyears in what's now St. George's Square, Oakland, because they had been there three generations as part of clubbing. There are still Larkins here. I grew up with Larkins here. They weren't at the compound at Forest and Chapin, but they were here. So it was that legacy that stayed here where their grandparents were. And then Buffalo State College has a huge underappreciated role in bringing people from out of town here, because the sort of the farthest away you can get from your family in New York City. That great boon for Buffalo, because it integrated so much of Elmwood. It brought art and culture and jazz in collaboration with the Albright Knox. And I think that was a big factor in beginning to attract people who saw the value of this place competing with the malls. So you think of positively Main Street, and you think of Alison Fleischman, and you think of the other. My mother had a little shop, Boutique Caprice, who made this sort of a trendy place for people who were not suburbanites. And it was Michael Attardo. It was Newell Nussbaumer. At the same time, you had outsiders who weren't so concerned about what was lost. They were saying, well, look what you have. Will Clarkson, in particular, who was Frank Kowski, whom you've interviewed, put together Buffalo architecture, basically put Buffalo on the map. That Charles Beveridge essay said, you have Olmsted Parks. No one knew that. Mm-hmm. People, you still run into people who grew up on park sites. I had no idea it was an Olmsted Park. Mm-hmm. So that was a big factor. Certainly Joan Bozer. I mean, she would have been chair of that group that, in the 1860s, Buffalo Park Commissioners, because he was such a strong leader. And Stan Lipsey. Mm-hmm. Stan Lipsey came here when Warren Buffett bought the Buffalo News. He fell in love with jazz. He fell in love with the bars.
So you had outsiders who moved into town who saying,
realized,
Buffalo, do you know what you have here?
And Stan told me that he commissioned McKinsey & Company when he came in here to figure out what's going on with Buffalo. And they're the ones, he said, who told them that you have a tremendous heritage here that you don't realize. And that's when Stan got involved with documenting Forest Lawn. He's got two books on Forest mm-hmm. Lawn. Saving the Martin House. He was behind the scenes, but he was instrumental in saving the Martin House.
Richardson Complex.
You know, what drove that was his goal of creating an architecture center. He wanted to take on an old building like that, but he wanted to have an architecture center that told Buffalo's architectural story. Mm. So I never got that McKinsey report. Maybe it was just a dialogue, but the point of it was that he was the first business leader, and at the time, the most powerful business leader in upstate New York, who realized the connection between Buffalo's future and its inheritance made all the difference in the world. Otherwise, it was a bunch of well-heeled people from Allentown and Elmwood who created the Landmark Society, which was a society the Preservation Buffalo Niagara carries on that legacy of activism and evangelism to say we have something worth saving. But Stan was the one who put it, and the realization that the National Historic Landmark Richardson was the place that really fit in well is what is driving that. And that there'll be good news about that Lipsey Architecture Center this summer. So that's sort of the high rollers and the regular people.
Yeah, I was going to say there were a lot of disparate, you know, one of the things that Buffalo has always had, you know, an abundance of are people who just roll up their sleeves on a grassroots level and take on a project. And we have so many stories of people who do that, and you can point to them. I mean, Newell, you came back to Buffalo in the 90s and you saw Elmwood and you dug in.
It was down and out at that point. I mean, it was a totally different. I mean, when I bought my house, which we are basically in right now, people said, wait, you're going to buy a house that close to Richmond? Like, you're nuts. And I was like, nope, this is what's going to happen. And ever since that, I mean, I had a store on Elmwood Avenue. But I could have chose one out of 50 different empty storefronts at the time to go in there. Positively Main Street was there. Campus Wheelworks was there. But I mean, other than that, I mean, it was a tough one. But I hooked up with Ward and Maureen Pinkle from Urban Threads, which they were very new to the scene. And they were the ones that basically said, you know, we can do this together. And we started going up and down Elmwood Avenue, cleaning it up. There's a little Needle Park right there, which is now where Globe Market is. And that was just like completely a mess. And you just kind of, you winged it. You didn't really know. There was no roadmap. Nobody told you what to do. You just went out your door and swept your, the first thing you did was sweep your sidewalk every day. And that's how it started.
So let's talk about where it is in present day. I mean, real estate prices are up considerably. There's some development that's happened along Elmwood. You know, what are some of the challenges that it faces currently, and what are some of the opportunities going forward?
There are inside forces and outside forces. Our entire country, our entire culture is going through a wrenching change of huge proportions. That goes back to Gutenberg's time. We haven't seen an era of information, democracy, technology all coming together to, as Marshall McLuhan said, it's a cause us to try to figure out who we are. So there aren't a lot of answers as we sort through this process. It could take a generation, could take a war. That's often what happens. On the other hand, inside, we have fewer children. So this was a neighborhood built for families and children. And we don't have that same number of families and children. We have a whole new demographic who does not have the money of their parents. They have student debt. They have good jobs. But they're concerned if they're raising children about where they're going to live for the school system. So there are these challenges that what's Elmwood's reason for being?
Right.
You can get anything you want anywhere. I just talked to someone in Elmwood residence saying, I'd like to buy local for my kitchen, but I asked the guy, I wanted a particular sink, which was, you can get anywhere, but it was one I wanted. I asked the local guy, can you bargain a little bit? Because he said, no, I'm not going to bargain. So I said, well, you know, I'm going to get it on the internet.
I mean, look at
retail. $200.
Right. And look at retail in general. I mean, retail, I can't even imagine being in retail on Elmwood these days, you know, or any place else for that matter. It's a completely different world.
And that's probably why we're seeing a preponderance of bars and restaurants.
Yeah. But the funny thing is, I wrote the other day that Mr. Sizzle's closing, I just thought that was such an unfortunate thing, because if you actually, it's one of the only places in the Elmwood Village where you see families all the time. You see, it's just an incredible thing to see. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is like a family experience that's about to like bite the dust. Fortunately, Lloyd Taco has just opened up in the old Thin Man space. I went over there for the first time because they just opened, and there were families all over the place. I was like, okay, this is because when Casa de Pizza closed, yep. You know, which is still, you know, I mean, that's a whole nother story for another podcast. But, you know, that was a great family place. You could go sit down and eat with your kids.
Your soccer teams.
Exactly. Yeah. Because you get a pitcher of Coke.
Not mine. The
you
kids.
Know? Well, right. Exactly. But like you get a pitcher of Coke and a pizza and like how many places aren't, there just aren't many places like that. So thankfully, Lloyd is, you know, taking up the charge there.
So those are those strengths that we can build upon. The co-op, we take for granted the co-op, but no other community has a co-op like our Lexington co-op. Mm-hmm. You know, the Hurdle one's different because Hurdle's more of an automobile era suburb, but we have some strengths. I think interesting that you should point this out. I'm holding the article in American Planning Association magazine, Elmwood Village, Buffalo, 2007. This was when Buffalo's Elmwood Village was named a top 10 mm-hmm. neighborhood almost 20 years ago. Mm. So is this a template we could look at and say, well, where do we stand today? And in terms of that heyday that earned national attention, and what do we have to do to earn it again 20 years later? It's something that Elmwood Village Association, I have to say, is beginning to grapple with. It's both an art and a science. It's not casual. It is something that needs to be very deliberate. And given the ability of our municipal governments to even do the most basic thing, they're so taxed and there's so much. I think it has to come from within.
Well,
have to be our own developers.
The thing about Elmwood also is it's like very like broken up, like unlike Hurdle. Like you can go to Hurdle.
You mean the Elmwood Avenue?
The Elmwood Avenue, yeah. Yes. Elmwood Avenue is very broken up, and it's there's opportunity there, but it's also very problematic. I've always thought because people will park in one section and they'll do that little section, and then they get back in their car and they leave. Whereas Hurdle, you know, it doesn't have those like residential those residential sections that break it all up. So every time a little house, a residential house on Elmwood Avenue gets occupied by the first floor commercial, I clap. I'm very excited about that.
I mean, there is a real opportunity to create some more contiguity along the avenue, you know, reduce the missing teeth. And I think we're coming to the end here. So I think you've outlined the incredible arc and history of this amazing neighborhood. We didn't mention that you were instrumental and actually led the charge on turning Elmwood Village into national, putting it on the national registry. So, you know, that kudos and thank you for doing that. Obviously, there continue to be demolition challenges, particularly as it becomes increasingly desirable in this neighborhood. And, you know, but again, resting on something you just said, how do we compare to when this accolade was first offered in 2007? Are we in a better place or in a worse place?
I do have one last thought, though. I want to get, what about, is there ever a chance to bring trolleys back to Elmwood, the trolley system?
The cost of the infrastructure is very high in terms of the benefit that it would produce. Mm-hmm. We need density. We need more people. Yeah. So we need this investment. We need density. We need to reinforce the use of the neighborhood without a car so it's more affordable to more people. And we have, in my mind, the thread that goes for the past, since 1800, is that this is a place that's always been a race for relevance. And we have that going on right now with 43 North, Bill mm-hmm. Maggio, and the other people who are creating a tech ecology. But that's sort of the 21st century version of Joseph Ellicott's laying out his plan as a utopian village. He deliberately said, this is a place designed by nature to be the grand emporium of the world. Mm-hmm. Why? Because he had to sell lots. And who's he going to sell lots to? People moving west who have a choice of staying in Albany, Syracuse, Rochester, here, or Cleveland. Moses Cleveland's doing the same thing there, later Detroit and Chicago. Why would anybody decide to come here? he said, you have a great future if you buy a lot from me in the village of Buffalo, New Amsterdam in 1804. Similarly, the park system we have is Buffalo business leaders saying we have to compete. We can compete. We're a top 10 city in population. We got to compete with New York City. We have to attract labor and capital. That's why they created the park system. And all the institutions we enjoy to this day are, most of them are post-Civil War. So if we adopt the same strategy that we can't wait for the man to come and save us, we have to save ourselves, which is what Alma and I and Ken Rogers and Wyatt Arthurs and others from the neighborhood created the coalition that attracted the funds to create the National Register of Historic Districts. So Alma and I could afford to re-roof our house and repaint our house because we'd get a state tax credit. The work of the Richardson Center Corporation, which is a private not-for-profit, working in tandem with government to reinvest in an idyllic landscape of health and wellness, which what that asylum was, a place where literally living there, you would feel a rearrangement of whatever was hurting you and mentally and emotionally and be able to leave. So we have that therapeutic health and wellness after the trauma of COVID, which is so similar to the situation after the Civil War. If we step up and do it, that's the hard part. We have to do it sweeping in front of our shops like you, Michael Attardo did,
yep.
Arranging flowers at the one level, but also in terms of developing policies and relationships in Elmwood to show we're all in this together.
Yeah, have more inclusion.
So what's interesting about this article is that they define Elmwood as being from Kleinhans Music Hall to the Albright Knox, and really a much brighter, wider swath than most of us think of. If we could begin to engage the entirety and not realize, think we're only living on the block we live on, I think that's something within our realm to do. And what you're doing with this podcast series and what you're doing with Buffalo Rising and your other entrepreneurial enterprises is doing that. And so we can't lose what we're doing, and we have something really positive to build upon. So thank you for the opportunity to be here.
Well, thank you, Clint. This was really fascinating, and we encourage everyone to read Homestead's Elmwood, and we'll provide a link to it in the podcast. So thank you again for coming by. Thanks, Noel.